Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
This is Sam Edwards, proud sponsor of Heritage Radio Network, SurreyFarms.com.
Hello, everybody. Hello, world. I'm Patrick Martins. This is the main course. It's Sunday, May... What is it?
13th. Mother's Day.
Mother's Day. Happy Mother's Day. Happy Mother's Day, Mom. Happy Mother's Day, all moms. Are you having lunch with your mom here at Roberta's?
Yeah, Atlanta? Mom and Grandma are coming over.
Very, very good. So it is packed at Roberta's. Everybody is super happy to be here. We're happy to be here. Thank you, Sam Edwards, for sponsoring us. Oh, man. So I have to not watch these political programs on Sundays.
Yeah, you came in kind of affected.
Yeah, well, I mean, I always joke about the fact that I hate white people. You know, I'm always like, you know, with rare exception, I hate white people. And, you know, Face the Nation and Meet the Press. I really miss Tim Russert, by the way, because he was a different breed of journalist. You know, on Face the Nation today, they had Clay Aiken on defending, you know, gay marriage. And, you know, he's very well spoken. You know, he wore a suit and tie. You know, it was great to see him up there. And then next to him was a guy who was just basically insulting Clay Aiken and all gay people right next to him. And the announcer, the host, never intervened. He never waited. It was like National Geographic. It was like Even Steven. He didn't ask any pointed questions or tough questions to the other guy. And it was just a form of, you know, I don't know what, it's not racism, but, you know, it's a form of some ism happening right there, face to face. And Clay Aiken's just sitting there taking it, you know, being called a freak and wrong and all that. Anyway.
Don't you think a little bit of it falls on Clay to stand up and defend himself?
No, he did. He did a great job, but he was trying to play the white man talk show game,
right.
In reality, the host, just like, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but I would have hoped that Walter Cronkite would have been, you know, at that time, like if he had a KKK guy on and Martin Luther King, that in the end he might try to call out the KKK guy, you know, as a punk, you know. And I don't know, I just would like, you know, where is the truth? You can't just go Even Steven with those guys, you know? And, you know, where is all the opinions? Where's all our leaders, you know? And I was just talking with Jack before the show, like, power to Michael Pollan. He's a guy who really gets into it and talks about the issues and says things that people don't like to hear. You know, Prince Charles is another one. He doesn't care. Like, he's using his platform to really communicate issues that people seem to be scared about. Like, I don't know. I kind of miss the 60s and, you know, 70s when people could say things and lead and, you know, people would like march on the streets and stuff. Anyway, so in happier news, we are both back from friends and family at Roberta's new restaurant, their fancy 12-seat restaurant called, it's called Tasting Room, right?
No, it's something with, I'll pull it up. It's with a B.
Okay. Well, that's what they call it in-house, is like, oh, the tasting room. And it was, how many courses, Jack? 24 courses?
I counted 28.
28 courses. First of all, did you do the drink pairing with it?
No, we got wine.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it started with caviar. I mean, there were 28 courses. I mean, imagine that. It takes like, how long? 4 hours?
Something like that, yeah. Blanca, by the way, is the name of the tasting room.
Blanca. Well, it is very white.
Yeah.
Carlo Mariachi, the chef of Roberta's, is basically like Hugh Hefner back there. It's like a massive Playboy mansion. It's like the largest kitchen. That whole restaurant is like 85% kitchen.
Josh Corey did an excellent job with the design there.
Josh is a real hero. You know, and also I should announce, this will tie right back to it. We've moved into a new space.
Yes.
Jack has an office. The first thing he put up was a Knicks poster. That's anyway, true. I really appreciated having a handyman. It was this guy, Dave, you know, who's a handyman in the neighborhood. And I was like, it's really good and nice to know a handyman, someone who can put a ventilation system in, do basic electric work, help you with your plumbing, you know, saw things in half, you know, whatever you need to do. And it's a kind of forgotten art form, I think.
20% of the kids going for liberal arts degrees would, you know, spend some time learning that stuff. The world would be a better place.
A much better place. And was that with you or Aaron who was talking? We were talking about the need to have a guy like him do a show.
Oh, yeah, that would be great.
It'd be real interesting to do a kind of how-to show with no visuals. You know, it'd almost be like teaching a blind person or something. You know, I mean, you get on a much higher plane. So anyway, yeah, that meal was really unbelievable. Incredible. Carlo did an unbelievable job. I mean, Garganelli and goat, ravioli sausage, prawns. He has this great frutta di mare, which he does in a kind of oily, heavy way.
Yeah, that was good. The gooey duck was actually very good.
The gooey duck was it was one of the best things on that plate.
Yeah, I agree.
And yeah, it's just all very interesting. And in a lot of those courses, you're just one bite. Did it loosen up at the end and were people mingling or did everyone stay on their island?
It didn't seem as social as the way you described your dinner, but it was a more random crowd.
Either way, we are part of the select few that got invited to friends and family.
I was very excited.
Well, I'm excited about today's show. We have a kind of, you know, behind the scenes guy at one of the very important restaurant groups here in New York City. His name is Ethan Richardson, and he actually is, I don't know exactly his title, but he helps run the behind the scenes of Jason Denton's restaurant group, which includes Eno, Enoteca, Corsino, Beto, and now Indy Food and Wine. And, you know, Jason Denton is kind of credited with introducing the panini into American food culture. You know, back in the 70s and early 80s, or even maybe all the 80s, you couldn't really find a panini. There might be one Italian place like Sant'Ambrose or something on 77th and Madison where you could. But, you know, nationwide, that it's everywhere now. So, and then, Jack, what do we have to announce? You've been doing some unbelievable. Before we call in to Ethan, who lives in Rochester, which we'll do in about 5 minutes, you have been doing an unbelievable job post-producing content from the station. So do you have a little surprise for
us? I do. And first, I'll say it's really the new office space, first of all, is incredible. Thank you for that. And second, it's great because all the time I'm faced with people saying, what's your favorite show? Or if you could tell me one thing to listen to, which would it be? And I always have a hard time answering that question because our programming is dense and there's so many shows. So now I'm editing down and post-producing a lot of the best moments into very accessible 1 to 5 minute clips, which is, it's a great way for people to get introduced to the station. And if they like what they hear, they can go find the shows and more. Anyway, we're calling them Jack's Picks. And one of the first ones I did is Chef Michael Anthony telling the story of how he became a chef. And congratulations to
Now, he's the chef of Gramercy Tavern,
and he just won the Best New York Chef Award at the James Beard Awards.
Given to him, no less, by his arch nemesis in the restaurant world.
Who would that be for you if you had to accept an award and your arch nemesis would give it to you?
Who would it be? This guy Neil, who is the nonprofit lawyer for Slow Food, but he wouldn't even get invited to the event. No, there'd be like maybe 15 people in the world that I would hate and maybe not even attend the event.
Yeah, really. Anyway, so I'm going to play a little piece of this just so you can get an idea.
So not only to have a head chef that was female, but also a business owner, she was a very tenacious person. I spoke just enough Japanese to show that I wasn't going to be a nuisance. Along the way, she decided that she was going to show me that working in a kitchen wasn't all that fancy a job. She was going to test me, and she really kind of beat it into me that, you know, the kitchen's a tough place to be, and it's not for just people who want to show off and hang out for a little while. And she taught me to love the kitchen for all of the right reasons, actually. I worked there for about a year and a half, and it was a tough apprenticeship. She taught me things and said things to me that I repeat almost every day. Right. You know, things like think about the job through before you start. Choose the right tool for the job. Pick the right pan. You know, it's Friday night. Get your butt down in the grease trap and scrub it with a hand brush because that's your job. So I learned the basics of good organization in the kitchen. I learned you have to take care of a kitchen for it to continue to operate. And then along the way, she taught me some really, you know, good basics to being a good cook. This particular Japanese chef opens.
Yeah, so that goes on for another few minutes, and he tells the whole story of how he went from Japan to executive chef at Gramercy Tavern.
Very, very interesting. And yeah, he just won Chef of the Year. I would love, Jack, actually, I know you have a laundry list that's like a book long now of ideas of stuff you should work on.
Keep it coming.
I would love Japan, like Japanese cooking talked about through the archives, you know, from the, maybe the four or five best people, because a remarkable number of chefs, including Mark Ladner, he was the first guy to tell me, I was like, what's your favorite cuisine? He's like, there's no doubt about it. Japanese cuisine. Mm. It's the most refined. And sure enough, Carlo starts a restaurant here, a tasting room with 12 seats. And what is it?
Yeah, very Japanese.
Mostly Japanese, you know. So it's interesting that chefs, if given the number one platform in the world, you know, are most attracted or attracted to that cuisine above any other. So
absolutely.
Anything else? So now you have your own office, your Knicks posters up there, more post-produced stuff. We have those two great new shows. Dorothy Cann Hamilton had Jacques Pepin in for
Incredible.
Her first guest.
What a nice man, too.
And he had been in the Times earlier.
Yeah.
That morning, I mean, I woke up to see Jacques Pepin as a 30-year-old, you know, doing like the
unreal
a dance around Craig Claiborne's kitchen, and then he comes on to HRN. And what did you think of the interview?
Unbelievable. He talked about the French Revolution and and watching his grandmother make things from the backyard. It was a really fascinating story. And Dorothy's a pro.
Yeah.
So those new shows are great. We've got Aaron Fairbanks as our executive director coming on full time now. So that's very exciting.
And tell us about Design Sponge. I mean, Grace Bonney is a mythical creature. She has like 800,000 followers.
You know what?
On
Speaking
Twitter?
Of which, I was sitting next to somebody at the tasting dinner, and they told me they listen to Heritage Radio, and they're way into Grace Bonney and Design Sponge. It's amazing how many people know her.
Yeah, no, I mean, she is doing a great job. The best man at my wedding, Toby, his girl is like, Grace Bonney's starting a show on your network. I'm like, how did you hear about it? Jack hasn't sent the email out. And then I'm like, oh, right. Grace Bonney is bigger than we are.
Yeah, Twitter.
Anyway, well, let's take a break, and we will come back on the phone with Ethan Richardson, who will tell us about how to run a restaurant group from behind the scenes.
Everyone is searching hard, gazing out upon the stars, realizing true love's hard to find. Many people won't awake, never making same mistakes, chasing dreams that soon leave them behind. It's your love.
Summertime is not the only time when barbecue is welcome. At S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, Sam Edwards has been working his magic on ribs, briskets, pit-cooked pulled pork, and much, much more. Add a few of their sides and the party is complete. Entertaining has never been so easy. To order, go to virginiatraditions.com.
Ethan, are you eating a panini right now?
No, Patrick, I'm afraid I'm not. How are you today?
Oh, very good. Thank you. You're not eating an egg panini?
No, I haven't actually had anything to eat today. I'm just having some coffee so far.
I hope it's a high-energy interview anyway. Well, thanks so much for calling in on a family Sunday.
Yeah, absolutely. Just real quick, happy Mother's Day to my wife on her first Mother's Day, and to my mom, my stepmom, mother-in-law, grandmas, all the moms out there today. I hope they're all having a great day.
And yes, happy Mother's Day to Anne. I mean, Anne is 4 months pregnant now, so, you know, I wish her a happy Mother's Day, and to her mom for giving birth to Anne. so is there a breakfast panini?
Yeah, absolutely.
What are the top two sellers?
Well, let's see. What have we done? We've done the pretty classic bacon, egg, and cheese in the past, you know, but with pancetta and fontina. With egg and basil pesto is always very popular. I mean, you can put any kind of egg sandwich you can put in a panini press, as far as I'm concerned.
Interesting. So now you grew up in Rochester and returned to Rochester.
Yeah, only in about the last year. My wife and I were both a little bit burned out on city living, wanted to be a little closer to family. And, you know, my partner Jason and I started chatting about it a little bit and sort of came up with a way for me to still stay really involved in the restaurants, but not necessarily be in Manhattan on a daily basis. So it's, you know, kind of an experiment that so far is working out really well for all of us.
I mean, I kind of run my business via phone anyway. But just to contextualize this for our listeners, this is... we're talking about Eno, which was like, Eno is the first restaurant that sold panini basically in the city, right? It's on Bedford Street?
Yeah, exactly right. Bedford between 6th and Downing. Jason opened Eno in 1998. You know, really at the time, there wasn't really panini anywhere. You know, Jason and his wife, Jen, had been in Italy for a wedding, and, you know, they were just really taken with a spot that is, you know, kind of like what Eno turned into, and they brought it back and opened it up. And, you know, it's really, I really do think the fact that you see panini in, or paninis or paninos or all the variant spellings and incorrect spellings in every mall in America is has a large part to do with Jason.
Is it a profitable, can it be very profitable to run a business based off of like an $8 or $12, $14 sandwich?
I mean, you know, I don't think Jason's profitability or profitability at the restaurants, you know, is pretty similar to any other place. A lot depends on your ingredients. You know, the better your ingredients, you're not going to make as much money as, you know, places using cheaper stuff. And obviously, we're really big on making sure our ingredients are the freshest and local and organic whenever they can be. And, you know, as a result of that, you know, I think we're, our profitability tends to be, you know, that of any other, you know, nice restaurant.
That's great. And now there's two Enotecas. Those were the next ones to open?
Yeah, that's right. The original Enoteca on Rivington Ludlow, where you and I met many, many years ago at this point, and where I got my start with Jason also many, many years ago. We actually just signed a new lease there, so we got another decade down on Rivington and Ludlow. We're very excited about that.
That place, you were the first ones in that neighborhood, you know, or I would say first good place to go to in that neighborhood for something quick and easy.
Yeah, it was pretty deserted back in the day. I mean, even for me, when I was, you know, working the floor down there as general manager back in 05, 06, 07, you know, there was a lot less down there. And, you know, I'm down there now a couple times a month, and it's amazing how many restaurants there are on the Lower East Side and how it's just, you know, it used to be kind of nothing, and then it used to be kind of a place to drink, and we were one of the only places to eat. And now there's, you know, six restaurants in every block. It's pretty unreal.
Yeah, it's amazing how per capita. And, of course, we have the Essex Street Market. I have my meat shop right there. So it's a block away, and I still love the way you have those plaques of the goat, the cow, and the sheep, and then all the cheeses listed under there. I mean, that's just the most perfect way of talking about cheeses. Now, what about Enotec Uptown?
Yeah, that opened in 2009, and that's a little bit more trattoria style. We serve pasta there. But, you know, similar a little more to the Murray Hill neighborhood in terms of the dynamic. You know, that's sort of the philosophy of all the restaurants in that, you know, there's a, you know, an underlying theme of really high-quality ingredients prepared simply in a fun atmosphere, you know, with great beverage programs. But that each restaurant is unique in its own way, that you have a different experience at each place because, you know, you're in a different part of town, and it's a different, you know, physical location. And, you know, just sort of letting them all kind of fill their own niche in their neighborhoods, but sort of a cohesive philosophy to all of them.
Yeah, for sure.
Really, you know, that's really the Jason Denton model, and that's what we've been, you know, really, really working on for the last, especially over the last year, especially with three openings since, let's see, late 2010.
Wow, that's interesting. Now, Enotec had a very unusual Enotec Uptown bar menu, and it was inspired by this guy. I don't know if you know his name, who I met. He was, like, paid as a consultant to come in, and he did these, fresh food.
Tony Abuganim.
Tony Abuganim from San Francisco, right?
Yeah, absolutely. He and Jason are friends going way, way, way back. And Tony came out to help get that program started. And it really just evolved into like a really fun boutique cocktail program there.
Well, what I like about it is how fresh fruit it is. You know, I mean, it's like you're drinking a fresh fruit off trees in Costa Rica, but there's liquor in there, you know? And it was like a kind of fruit punchy, super unusual, bar selection. Then what about Corsino? That's turned in. I mean, that place is packed all the time. That's on Hudson, right?
Yeah, Horatio and Hudson, so sort of right on the edge of the West Village and Meatpacking. And Jason opened that in October 2009, I believe. And Corsino's really kind of, a trattoria. It's still got that same Jason Denton vibe, but there's a lot of great pastas. And it's just, it's a great place to go for lunch or dinner. It's just more of Jason's philosophy of good, simple food, and it sort of fits right in there on that corner and really pops with those red colors. It's just a cool place. I love it.
Now, my favorite place is Beto, and I think that's the restaurant everybody should go to if they haven't been. Plus, it's in such a dynamic neighborhood, and, Williamsburg has that gritty kind of connotation to it, but where you guys are, it's actually very tailored and lovely, and you're part of a great restaurant group there, Issa, and you guys, people should definitely go out there. Tell us about Beto.
Yeah, Beto's a really cool space. That was the first foray out into Brooklyn, and we opened there last summer. And it's sort of like a split-level area. You've got a street-level kind of cafe right in the front, and then it kind of goes up about a half a level where we've got this amazing concrete communal table that seats, 12 or 14 people. And just really cool bar. Really nice design there. It's just really sort of sleek, not quite as rustic as the other places. Maybe it's got a hint of industrial, which I think Williamsburg has, and just more really solid food. And that's also the place outside of just Italy in terms of the wine selection and great beer program there as well. The cuisine is still probably pretty Italian, but I think we've allowed a little more of Mediterranean influences in there as well. And it's a really fun place, and I hope more people check it out, because it's not on a corner. You got to walk up half a block from Bedford, but definitely worth the trip.
And let me ask, are these restaurants similar in style and look to Jason's uncle's restaurants in San Francisco? He was a very famous restaurateur there. Have you seen any of those restaurants that made Jason's uncle so famous?
I haven't. Shamefully, I've never been to the Starlight Room. But from what I understand, that's definitely a lot more fancy sort of place, a little more like a nightclub.
Okay.
Unfortunately, I do know Uncle Harry. I haven't seen him in a couple of years, but I can't speak too much to exactly what he's up to out there these days.
Uncle Harry is a legend. I mean, he ran court. He held court. I mean, they don't make him like that. He's like the Merv Griffin, or, he's just like a big, larger-than-life character that Jason learned a lot from.
No, absolutely. I think that's where the passion originally came from. He's larger in life in real life, too. He's a hilarious guy.
Tell us about the final restaurant that just opened, Indie Food & Wine.
Sure. We opened Indie Food & Wine in September of last year, and that is really kind of branching out to something totally new for Jason. We're inside the Eleanor Bunnen Monroe Film Center Film Center, within the Lincoln Center complex. So we're right there across the street from Juilliard on 65th Street. By day, it's basically a lunch counter sort of place, kind of like a Pret or a Pax. But obviously, everything is made to order from super fresh ingredients, just like all of Jason's places. It's a great place to get a coffee, get a sandwich, a bowl of soup. We do breakfast there, too. And then around 5 p.m., we kind of change things up a little bit. Table service starts, and it turns into a really neat little wine bar. And I don't think there's really too many places out there, doing both those things in the same space. And plus, we've got movie theaters right inside the same building. So it's really been a new concept and a real learning experience for us. But I think it's just a fantastic restaurant. And it's our first foray that far uptown, too. So for those people on the Upper West and Upper East Side that don't always want to come way downtown, it's definitely a place they should check out.
Well, I'll respect it a lot more if you keep going uptown. Harlem is calling. We should all be investing more in you know, other neighborhoods like that. But yeah, keep on going. So now you were there in 2004. You started working with Jason's group, right?
Yeah, actually, it's too long a story for today, but I was living in New Orleans with my woman who's now my wife for almost 7 years. We were, you know, I was working at the Windsor Court Hotel, actually. Somehow I'd stumbled into the sommelier position at the age of, I think I was 21 or 22. And that was a great gig. We were really having a lot of fun, but it was time to, you know, we were really far from family in a lot of ways, and so we actually came up to New York because Andrea was going to try out law school, and that didn't work out for her, but she now has a very successful career in the nonprofit sector. But for me, I was trying to figure out what to do with life, and, you know, I was thinking maybe I should get out of the restaurant business, and I stumbled in with Jason because I was looking to make some money, actually. I needed to get a job waiting some tables or something to pay the New York City bills, and I was thinking about going to graduate school, and in the end, that evolved into a partnership that's now 6-7 years old.
So, yeah, so you went from 04 to 07. You became partners. So what did you offer him that other people didn't?
Well, I mean, I don't know that someone else in a similar position couldn't have wound up the same way, but, you know, Tech at Rivington Street needed a good general manager. We were going through a really strong growth phase at that point, you know, someone that could really get systems and operations in place, and it turned out that, you know, I really had a knack for that, and, you know, I also had a pretty ridiculous work ethic. There were a few years...
Yeah, I always saw you there. I always saw you there.
Yeah, that's where I was all the time. You know, we were really able to grow that business, and so, you know, we wanted to keep working together, and partnership was part of, you know, a reward for my efforts. You know, they call it sweat equity.
Mm-hmm. And Jason taught me...
No, I was just going to say some of my equity is from capital at this point, but really it's a pretty old-fashioned, you know, started at the bottom, so to speak, you know, it just happened to be a great fit. And here we are 7 years, 8 years later.
Yeah, Jason taught me early on because he was once the owner of Lupa Restaurant, which was Heritage Foods' first customer.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
And, you know, we go through 50,000 pounds of meat a week now, every single week, you know, on our regular weeks when we don't have other stuff, and that's due in large part to Jason's investment in us. And he always said it's better to own a little of a lot than a lot of a little, you know. And I always thought that was great advice, and I admire him for making guys like you, who are obviously great spokespeople and you know, in a way middle management, you know, to begin with, but to make them owners is so smart because it engages you, it keeps, you know, people focused, and in the end, you don't really give up that much. You know, you're just giving up such a sliver. So I love Jason's ownership style, you know, of sharing the wealth and responsibility and all that stuff. But now you pretty much run the financial and big picture, kind of all the bureaucratic aspects of this whole restaurant group, right?
Yeah, that's pretty much right. there's a lot to it. It's a complicated business.
I mean, how much of your time is spent doing what? I mean, so from Monday, take us through a week of someone who runs the financial big picture and all operational and bureaucratic aspects of the group. I mean, what does that consist of?
Sure, I mean, there's a lot of boring stuff, but, you know, it's all got to be done. For one thing, you know, you've got an awful lot of vendors that need to get paid. You got an awful lot of employees that need to get paid. And, you know, so to make sure that that's all getting done smoothly and correctly as best you can is a big part of it. You've got, you know, you just have things that come up in the restaurant business. You have six general managers that have lots of questions, so there's lots of emails back and forth there. Maybe there's some kind of license or permit that needs to get renewed. You know, there's a lot of paperwork. There's definitely a lot of busy work that has to happen with any business. But, you know, in the business of serving food and serving alcohol, there's a lot of government involvement that's not necessarily brought to bear in other businesses. And certainly it's a good thing if you're serving people food and helping them catch a buzz. But that requires a lot of time and attention. So, you know, and then there's just a lot of unexpected things that just seem to come up, you know, it's running a restaurant is very much like running a household, but it's a lot bigger. I think that's a pretty good metaphor for your listeners. If you think about all that goes into, you know, keeping up your apartment or your house, it's really quite a lot like that, except you have a lot more people coming through for dinner.
A lot more garbage is generated.
Exactly right, exactly right.
Well, it's an interesting thing. Now, do all your neighbors look at you and be like, what the hell's he doing in his house all day?
Yeah, I mean, I even feel like that. We have a baby, and we've had a nanny for a couple months now. And at one point, I was like, you know, I have a feeling you don't really think I do anything, but just so you know, there's a lot of truthfully, there's a lot of decision making that I have to make, and then part of my job is to be responsible for making operational decisions, and so I do spend a lot of time just thinking about things and thinking about how we need to proceed with this problem or that problem, we employ several hundred people, and making sure that that's all as it should be, and that we have happy, productive employees who want to do a good job, and there's an awful lot that goes into that too. It's very much a relationship business. Even if I'm not necessarily speaking with people every day in person, there's just it's a lot of moving parts to keep to try to keep moving smoothly.
What takes up the majority of your time? What single aspect of it? Is it overseeing all the accounting?
Yeah, I think that probably is. Just because that is, you do some math and it adds up pretty fast. We deal with literally 40 plus different vendors for alcohol, wine and spirits and beer.
And I know you go through a lot of meat purveyors and small farm purveyors. I mean, all your restaurant group is so dedicated towards sustainable production, which is why we're so happy to cover all of them on this network. I mean, they're all kind of quote unquote slow food, snail earning restaurants.
No, I mean, that's absolutely true. We're at the Green Market all the time when it's happening. We're ordering from you guys. We're ordering from Satter Farms. We're ordering from, just anywhere we can find good products that are produced, as well as possible. We're going to go after that. And, we don't really worry about how many checks we have to cut. But at the end of the day, you're quite right. Some of the small farmers, we have to, because they are such small farmers, we need to arrange to, pay them when we pick up products, or we need to pay cash. So there's a lot. There's a whole lot in terms of the accounting aspect because we do deal with so many different people to try to bring the best possible products to our customers that it makes a lot of paperwork. That's probably the least interesting part of my job, but to answer your question, it probably takes up the most of my time.
So can you really work from Rochester and still have a major influence on the restaurants? Has that been a challenge?
I think it's been a challenge to try to sort out what I can do most effectively from here and what other things I need to find ways to delegate to people who are on the scene. And that's, sort of been an evolving part of all of this. But, is the double-edged sword of the iPhone is that I can only do this because of all this technology. But at the same time, like so many other people in business and in other industries today, I don't really ever get to unplug either. But you can do an awful lot remotely, and I do travel to the city. I'm usually in the city 3 to 4 days a month, I do get my FaceTime as well.
Now, tell us a little bit about your local, your locale in Rochester. Tell us about how, the other people that we only see on television live. No, just kidding. But you know what I mean? Like, what is the true foodscape of a city? And I know it might have a couple of great success stories, but is the success deeply rooted and pervasive, like all over the place, or is it still the bastion of just a few?
We're talking about the food scene primarily?
Yeah.
I mean, I think that slow foods and organic and local has really pervaded, nationally at this point. Rochester, for your listeners who don't know, we are way far away from New York. We're about 340 miles, pretty much on the south shore of Lake Ontario. We're nowhere near New York City, and certainly no place is ever going to be New York City. That's why it's New York City. That's why people are willing to, pay crazy rents for tiny apartments and live, like ants in some ways. You get an awful lot. You get 10 Indian restaurants that all deliver to your apartment, for instance, whereas I have one Indian restaurant that I got to drive to pick up. But you know what? It's really pretty good. Obviously, you can never compare a small city to a place like New York or Chicago or L.A., but there's some great restaurants here. There really are. And I found some really good food. I found some really good authentic Italian food. There's a pretty excellent wood-fired pizza scene going on in Rochester right now.
Give us your top three restaurants. If someone found themselves in Rochester or the area, what three places would you send them first?
Sure, they should go to Good Luck for cocktails and maybe some snacks, and then they should probably go to Rocco for pizza, and then maybe Owl House for lunch the next day. Those are probably my top three places right now.
Okay, say those again.
Yeah, Good Luck is
good
the first
luck.
One. And then Rocco, R-O-C-C-O.
Okay.
And then Owl House.
Owl House, that's what it was. All right, awesome. Now, of course, New York in that area has what might be one of the top one or two grocery store chains in the country, two or three maybe. I mean, in terms of quality and size and impressiveness, and actually it's voted, I think, one of the top 25 companies in the country to work for in terms of how they support it. It's Wegmans, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Tell us about Wegmans. People around the country might not have ever heard of Wegmans, but...
Wegmans is pretty overwhelming. I mean, I would, I think the best comparison in some ways is Whole Foods, but I think that Wegmans does a little bit better. I'm privileged enough that where I reside in Rochester, I live very, very close to their sort of flagship store. So not to say that every Wegmans is as extravagant as the one I shop at, but and it's pretty unreal. Go to the fishmonger and, they've got whole monkfish sitting out, which I've never even really seen whole monkfish on display. The grocer, for your listeners that don't know, it's not really an attractive fish, but, Wegmans puts it out there and people buy it because it's just great stuff. Apparently, they fly Kobe beef in from Japan weekly. But at the same time, as sort of unsustainable as that is, Wegmans does have really deep relationships with local farmers, insofar as I understand, and it's, you can get some pretty fantastic local produce at the grocery store. There's also a great, great farmer's market scene here in Rochester too. Just sort of behind my house in at Brighton High School is an outstanding market where we get all kinds of great organic stuff, vegetables and meats all summer long. And I think Rochester's public market, which is 100 plus years old, I don't have the statistic, but a year or so ago, it was voted one of the best public markets in the country. So it is really a progressive place in a lot of ways. There's definitely that slow foods, organic, local interest pretty strong here.
And they give a lot of samples out, and they don't care if you come back four or five times, or at least that's the one experience I had at a Wegmans.
That's true. That's true. And the prepared foods they'll empty your wallet, but they'll also blow your mind with the scale and scope of what you can get.
Now, it's funny that you mentioned Wagyu, because Jack and I went to a 28-course friends and family over here at Blanc. Is that right, Jack? Blanc?
It's Blanca.
Blanca. And he had three beef dishes, I think, two or three, and they were all Wagyu, or the Kobe, which is like a form of Kobe.
45-day aged.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? It really is proof the breed has some effect, because he could have picked any beef slivers to offer, and yet he chose Wagyu for all three. That's great that they bring in some of that stuff, because that is, arguably the best beef in the world. So very, very interesting, to have you on. I mean, I guess my last question for you, and thanks so much for calling in on a Sunday. I mean, it's great to have you on. I've known you for decades, and you always had this way you conducted yourself and in your beliefs you always wore on your heart sleeves. I mean, you're very earnest in communicating your kind of core values. So tell our listeners what those are, because you've been a real warrior in the restaurant industry for a decade. So what do you want to leave with it? I mean, what have you tried to bring to that world?
Well, I think that it's important to think about what we do in a broader context as restaurateurs, and it is by its nature to some extent a little bit of a wasteful business. People don't always finish their dishes, to go where, that sort of stuff. So I think we really have an imperative as restaurateurs to really kind of embrace the sustainability and to also embrace the importance of food in our lives. People always sort of say it like it's a metaphor, but you very literally are what you eat, and I feel very strongly about that, and my family feels very strongly about that, and Jason and I, as restaurateurs, feel strongly about that it's worth taking the time to have something that's really good, and it's worth spending a little bit more money, whether it's your grocery shopping at home or when you go out to eat, to see that what you're eating is really of a high quality, because that's who you are. We could talk for another hour about and say nothing that Michael Pollan hasn't already said, but I really think that it's important that we really keep that in mind, in that, yes, it's a business, and profitability and cost cutting and so on and so forth, those are all important things, but I do believe that as small business owners, we do have responsibility to have a corporate conscience in the way that, say, other large companies, especially in the food service industry, really don't.
Mm-hmm. Well, you were always a consummate professional, and both Ann and I have great respect for, you know, every time for you, every time we saw you, all the times, late at night, early, all the time, you were always consistent, and, you know, that's ultimately, you know, a great standard for people to uphold. Is there a website for the restaurant group that people could
yeah,
go to?
Yeah, absolutely. The best place to start is if you go to The Eno Group, TheEinoGroup.com. You can see all six restaurants there with quick links to the restaurant web pages, and we also most definitely encourage everyone to check us out on Facebook and Twitter. Some really, really cool stuff going on with the social media on a daily basis. So be sure to check us out there.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Ethan, for being on. Thanks so much, Jack, for engineering and producing. And Katie Kiefer is going to have her show coming on right now called Straight No Chaser, followed by Mike and Judy Show, and then a couple of others.
Yeah, Googa Mooga's on the morning after today.
Exciting.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.